Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco of California. Already, it's off track. Tonight's event is part of the club's Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Eli Horowitz, former managing editor and publisher at McSweeney's, and your moderator for today's program. And tonight, I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Charles Yu, author of the new book, Sorry, Please, Thank You. Mr. Yu named one of the 535 fiction writers to watch by the National Book Foundation, is the author of the acclaimed How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe and Third Class Superhero. Mr. Yu now returns with a story collection, Sorry, Please, Thank You. Please welcome Charles Yu. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Eli.
Hi. I was thinking we could start by talking about the first story in this collection, Standard Loneliness Package, and you can probably talk better than me about the topic, but it seems like very much a science fiction story and also very much a personal story, which kind of sums up the collection as a whole, and so I'm sort of curious about those two concerns and how you balance them when you're approaching a story.
That's exactly the way it happens for me. For better or worse, it's often it's an idea first, and then the idea is interesting, and I'm trying to sort of explore offshoots of the idea and fill it out, and then at some point it becomes a little too empty of an idea, and I'm like, I have to fill this with people, so let's put the people in there. And so the hard part is figuring out how to fill it with people in a way that feels sort of organic with the idea.
And so that story is about an emotional engineering firm in India. Do you want to describe the premise a little more?
So yeah, the premise is that this is Earth. It's near future, and you can now, for a fee, outsource the bad parts of your life. It's almost like you call your broker and you say, I've got an hour dental appointment coming up. I don't want to do it. Someone else will experience this pain for me. But in the story, it's not just dental appointments. It's funerals. It's even experiences that you would think were sort of central to life. People just outsource them because why go through it if you don't have to? And so this sort of explores it from the perspective of somebody who is sitting in a call center in India and has to basically open their, you know, they sit at a cubicle and they open their screen, and then through the technology in the story is the consciousness transfer protocol. And so basically at the time of the switch, the technology, you know, shifts the paying customer into some kind of false memory where they can just, it's sort of like a mental waiting room. They just sit there for an hour and read a magazine or have a drink. And then the bad experience, the qualia, gets, I don't know what that word means, but I've read it in many philosophy texts that I've browsed in the bookstore. And so the bad experience gets shifted to the worker who has to then experience it.
And so from what you were saying before, you're saying that the premise, the sort of high concept premise, is what comes first often in the creation, and then the personal angle is what follows that?
Yeah. Yeah. The high concept premise is the, you know, it's the body of the vehicle, but it won't go until I figure out a way to make myself care about it too. But also I'm thinking someone's got to read this. I can't just write 18 pages of ideas. I mean, I could, but
Are you sometimes confronted with a premise that you think is just a great premise in itself, but just no story will cohere around it, no flesh on the skeleton, sort of?
Yeah, definitely happens. And then so I'll spend a lot of time trying to graft something to that skeleton, and it just falls off. That's kind of where the organic part comes in, because, you know, I mean, as an editor, you probably maybe see it. I don't know how you think about it, but sometimes it feels like something is found versus built. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's an artificial distinction because it's all built, obviously, by the writer. But sometimes, for whatever reason, it feels like there is one sort of more right way to sort of flesh out that idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely feels like with all the stories in this collection, it feels like you believe them. I mean, they all feel weirdly personal. Hmm. And, I mean, even just as a simple thing, almost all of them are first person. Mm-hmm. There's maybe one second person and one or two where person doesn't really apply.
Yeah.
Do you find that first person angle helps, makes it easier to get at that emotional core of the story? Or
That would be a generous way of putting it. That's like... I know how to drive in 1.5 gears uh-huh. right now, and I'm like, I'd like to learn how to drive the whole car, but you know, I think I'm sort of riding around my limitations in a way.
Do you set up conscious goals like that for yourself? Like, now it's time to write in a third person and see if I can do it?
I do. I have like an aspirational list. Uh-huh. Not going that well right now, uh-huh. but I definitely have things where I know it feels like, okay, I've done that. Not that I've mastered it, but I've done it. Maybe I should try something else. Not like in a eat my vegetables kind of way, like I should do this. Mm-hmm. Like I want to do it. Why would I keep doing the same thing over and over again? And plus, why would people want to read the same thing over and over again? So,
are there any kind of specific, relatable things that are on that list, like a story in free verse or... you know, no vowels or something like that?
Right. I think a story that has absolutely no metafictional elements would be nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I've never done that, but it feels like a lot of the things lately have been so concerned with, like, the machinery of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I really love to tell a straight, good story.
Mm-hmm. And your novel, of course, had Charles Yu as the protagonist. What do you think it is that draws you to those concerns?
I think that what I'm interested in is looking at the conventions of genre in that novel, the conventions of science fiction, as a way of thinking about assumptions that that we make about sort of ourselves and how we go through life. I mean, if that makes any sense at all. The embedded assumptions of science fiction are interesting to me in a way, you know, in sort of like a way of looking at, well, how do we tell stories about ourselves and what kind of stories, why do we make these rules about stories versus other rules?
Mm-hmm. Is there anything about science fiction specifically that you feel is particularly useful for raising these questions?
Yeah, I do. I think so. Well, I think it. I don't know. It could be that it's the only genre I have any kind of working knowledge of.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also maybe to my mind, the richest set of those rules. I mean, there's just so much science fiction. We're like saturated in science fiction, and it's something that I think people. It's a very sort of identifiable. Set of conventions is very, that reduces it too much, but you know, if you say time travel, then that just conjures lots of stories, you know, and Back to the Future, it just has all sort of references come to mind immediately, and that kind of, to be able to draw on that many references with a kind of quick shorthand is useful and kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, because science fiction is a literature of like speculation and also of technology and looking at the future, those all kind of coincide with, you know, what I'm interested in looking at anyway.
Did you grow up reading science fiction, or some more the movies and pop culture manifestations of it?
More the latter. I was not a heavy science fiction reader, mm-hmm. but definitely consumer of mm-hmm. it in various forms.
Right. It seems almost on a sentence level your stories owe more to people like George Saunders or Kurt Vonnegut than to Ray Bradbury or someone like that.
That would be. I would like to think so. I'm going to agree with you, but that would be who my sentences are aspiring, I guess, to be. But mm-hmm.
Are there unexpected people who you feel have influenced you as a writer?
Hmm.
Like. you really Alice Munro or mm-hmm. Beowulf or something like that?
One slightly out of left field one might be Nicholson Baker.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to create what I think is like the supreme interior space, that to me is like, that's what, I know that's not what a novel is, but that's like almost the only way I know how to conceive of a novel right now, is the kind of thing that he does where, you know, it's like he gets a tube and connects it from, you know, the inside of his brain, and now you're all of a sudden you're listening, you know, like a cardboard tube inside of his, you mm-hmm. know, inside of his head. I don't know how he does that, but that's definitely something that when I was trying to write How to Live Safely specifically, it was something that I was thinking about a lot.
It does seem like you're a lot more interested in selves and identity than you are in actual technology or scientific advances.
Yeah.
I mean, do you even pay attention to, like, do you have any feelings about the Higgs
boson?
Boson.
I do.
Yeah? What are your feelings about it?
I am, you know, well, I mean, speaking as a world-class physicist, I'm a little disappointed I didn't find it. Someone else found it.
Apparently it's all over the place. I don't know, it took you so long. I found it a while ago. I just didn't think it was
you
a
did?
Big deal to mention it.
That little thing?
So it's quite small.
Right.
I've found better things I haven't even brought up yet.
There's so many of them.
I know.
What did you do? You found one.
Come on.
I do have feelings about it. I mean, I think, one, it was, first off, it was extremely exciting to see physics on the front page of the New York Times. That was cool. How often does that happen these days? And, you know, I love the sort of the science written by a scientist for the lay audience type book. I can't get enough of it. And I, you know, a big part of that is I feel like 100 years ago there was all these incredible discoveries. And I know there are discoveries now, but maybe it's just there's so much other news. It just doesn't feel like science is a huge part of the news, and I wish it were. And so when that happened, that was super exciting. I guess, from what I understand, it was a little bit... some people have said it's a little disappointing that it actually matches what they thought it was supposed to be, and it sort of confirms the standard model. Because the way I understand it, and here I'm way past my out of my depth, but is that there's a standard model, which is incredibly successful scientific theory, right? I mean, I guess I've heard it described, or quantum mechanics, or the standard model as a kind of the most successful scientific theory there is in terms of being able to predict things that we have, right? And yet, in a very, I guess, basic sense, it's so incomplete, and they know it, because it doesn't take into account gravity, or they can't sort of reconcile gravity with quantum mechanics, the big, huge rift. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that there's dark matter and dark energy, whatever. I mean, it just sounds like science fiction, right?
Right.
That's science. And those two, dark matter and dark energy, apparently compose 96% of the stuff in the universe, and there's no theory on it. It's not even a guess as to what that is, uh-huh. I don't think. So the standard model, which is the very best thing that we have so far, is explains 4% of the universe. So, like, I think in that sense, it was probably a sad thing that the Higgs was like, oh, that's what we thought, because it's like it would have been better if it had blown a hole in the whole thing, and then everyone had been trying to figure out
the whole new one.
Yeah.
Well, here's a more optimistic take on it is, I mean, you could say that it the kind of remarkable thing about it was, you know, when you hear the theory, it almost doesn't make any sense. It's ridiculous. It gives mass to things. I can't even say anything more than that. But it's comical.
Right.
But yet physicists were able to just create the theory based on what should be there. There should be a particle like this.
Right.
And then they found it. They imagined a particle and then they found it. So I'm going to posit to you that it's almost an inspiring thing from a fiction writer's perspective, because it's almost like a mental creation that then came into being,
right,
which is almost what you're engaged with as a writer.
Yeah. You have posited it. So deposited.
I've heavily posited.
There it is.
I would like to go onto the radio record as positing this theory. I mean, do you have aspirations as a science fiction writer that you will imagine something that will come true? You know, that in 2112, they'll be like, a little-known novel and, you know, actually presented the whole world as it is today.
Well, you know, okay, I guess backing up a little bit before you posited that. I mean, I didn't mean to put such a negative spin on it, because I think it is, it's sort of like Newton's sort of like, you know, equations that describe force, right? Those still work to, like, however many decimal places on Earth in any normal situation. That we could usually measure in everyday life, Newton's equations work perfectly, basically, mm-hmm. for all intents and purposes. So, and yet, that has really, you know, apparently nothing to do with how gravity, it just happened to be a special case that he found and that worked for the way we see life. So, you're right. It's amazing that they knew that there was gonna, or they predicted this Higgs would be just like this, and it was just like that. So the standard model, whatever it is, must be basically not must be. Here's now I'm positing. it feels like that's what's going on, right? It, like they got it right. Amazing. That is amazing. And I guess it's just maybe I'm impatient, but I'm waiting for like the next thing. But to actually answer your question, I mean, yeah, that would be like my number one goal would be like to actually predict something that in like 30 years, like, oh man, Charles, you totally predicted that. That'd be better than like writing an awesome book and right. be like, yeah, I totally saw that one.
But you do have to kind of moderate them to make sure they're not 100-year predictions when you'll be dead.
And this is what I think about
like
when I'm
30 years.
How much of a visionary right. do I want to be?
How much would you say that defines your process, things that you will live to see as opposed to things? Here's a question about process that comes from the audience. In your book, a couple of pieces reflect your mind's own conversation with itself. These are sort of the more, on some level, the more metafictional pieces in the book. How well would you say that these reflect your writing process? Are these sort of the debates that you're engaging in as you're creating the piece?
Yes. I am capable of giving a concise answer. No, that absolutely, yeah. Sometimes it not always, but sometimes it feels like, oh, the process kind of is part of the end product, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel when you finish the story that you've resolved something internally, or
no, not always. You mean resolved in terms of like?
Well, now you feel kind of at peace with this dilemma.
No, hardly ever. Uh-huh. Yeah, no. I think if I'm finding an answer, that's probably bad, right? Because I'm looking, for the most part, at like questions of identity or mm-hmm. the nature of self.
So to the extent that you are thinking about identity and self and almost existential crisis, I would say most of these books are almost existential crisis in one way or another, whether it's sort of cartoonish in the best possible way with sort of like a role-playing character trying to figure out where he is in his quest, you know, versus other stories that are more obviously and nakedly about, you know, someone wrestling with their identity. What is it about science fiction and fantasy that makes you feel like that's useful for addressing those things, which are, in some sense have been around since, you know, Socrates or Rousseau or anybody,
right.
you know? Why go futuristic to address those?
Yeah. Because it's fun. Uh-huh. It's fun for me. And I think what's neat about it, though, is that Socrates could... I don't think Socrates played video games. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, so, in two senses, a video game is interesting. One, as a new way of exploring very old things. Maybe. In a way that a video game has a certain kind of visual, like, layout. But it also has a kind of conceptual layout, right? If I try to... My mom has played some video games. But if I try to explain to, say, my mom's mom, who's, you know, like, if she were here, if I were to try to explain to her how to play a video game, it would not compute, right? I mean, I'm sure it would eventually.
It wouldn't even not compute. It would be not even something less than computing.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas if, I mean, already I've got kids and, you know, my 4-year-old and 3-year-old, if I showed them a little guy on a screen, they would know that that guy probably jumps. Mm-hmm. And that guy probably is supposed to jump over the hole being a gap, a two-dimensional gap on a two-dimensional. I mean, so this kind of like way of, these are artificial environments and they might seem, they are cartoonish, right, by definition, I guess, but they are also places where we spend lots of time. And so, and then the other part of it is just that, yeah, that's what I grew up with. So that's how I, those are environments I'm comfortable mm-hmm. sort of navigating.
Sort of following that up, do you feel, you know, it's interesting in your novel, the title, The Science Fictional Universe, that's obviously set in some future time, but are we now in a more science fictional universe than when the classic science fiction was being written? I mean, do you think it's sort of embodied almost? I was thinking about this when you were talking about, in some ways, we're less conscious of scientific advances than 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if that's because it's just more ubiquitous in our existence.
I mean, I definitely think that there's something to that. But I do, sometimes I've given some thought to, like, are we past, if you could draw like the world history curve in terms of tech, if there were such a thing, a technology curve, is there some inflection point past which it's always going to feel like we're living in a crazy sci-fi universe more and more? And my one sort of partial stumble on an answer on that is that I think there is. I think we're at a point now that the rate of technology the pace at which technology advances moves so fast within a human lifetime that you are now guaranteed to be mystified by what your grandkids are looking at. Whereas I'm not sure that was true before. I mean, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. 1400 to 1500,
right.
battle axes, probably, right? 1900 to 2000 and then 2000 to 2100, I just think that gap, and then it's just going to get, I assume it's going to get more unless there's an apocalypse. I think there will be it's going to be worse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can't even imagine what like my kids' kids are going to be using.
Are there particular things you're yearning for?
Yes, flying car. Because I was stuck in traffic yesterday for 2.5 hours. I was late to a book reading, and they desperately need to get to work on that. I mean,
don't you feel? I mean, traffic can exist up there too. You think there's going to be no roads in flying cars?
No, I just need one for
you
myself.
You need one flying car.
I don't want any more flying cars.
That might exist. Yeah. Well, how's that different than a plane?
That's a good point.
I just invented it. Now you can rest easy. Do you feel any? I mean, we've talked about this, but the relationship between science fiction and science. I mean, do you feel an obligation to science, and do you feel any obligation to, if not education, at least stimulation? I mean, do you want people to care about the new particles and so forth?
Yeah, uh-huh. Kind of. I mean, I feel a little bit like a tiny mouse. You know, I wish I had a bigger megaphone, but with my tiny, tiny, I guess it wouldn't be a megaphone, my microphone, my nanophone, I do feel like if I were to be able to broadcast one tiny thing, it might be my excitement for sort of like that kind of mystery and wonder that I feel anyway when I'm, you know, and again, this is really, it's like, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, you know what I mean, clearly, and I'm also not even like really equipped to understand scientists the way they're thinking about science, but I think that way of thinking about things, that there's this huge, you know, there are huge mysteries. I mean, that's never, you know, that I don't know that you need training to feel that. And so that's what excites me.
So you mentioned you're not a scientist, you're a lawyer professionally. And in this book, in your book and in your novel, there's a lot of workplace. There's kind of a lot of mundane workplace as the setting for these things. But it never is, there's no law. Something that seems to never come up in this because it's, is that inherently boring? You're just trying to get away from it? Or do you see anything? Are you embarrassed to be a lawyer?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I think, There should be. I should write a law story. Thank you.
What is the future of law? Do you feel like does it lend itself differently to
robots? Probably robots lawyers.
Robots, yeah. Practicing, or can they be criminals too? Could you try a robot for a crime?
I think you just hit on the next subject of my next novel.
Maybe there's a, because, well, you know, eventually they'll be indistinguishable from people, presumably, right? So then you got the robot on the stand. The lawyer, who no one knows is a robot, has to decide whether to whatever or against his own kind and so forth and so on. Is that the kind of law you practice, Charles?
That's it. That's what I don't want to talk about.
What kind of law do you practice?
I work in-house at a company that does visual effects for the movies and for TV commercials. So I am sort of a generalist. I could do all kinds of stuff.
Sort of intellectual property and things.
Some of that. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And everything else that comes in sort of day to day. And that actually offers a very good, that's just a huge sort of part of my experience. Like I work 10 hours a day or more, and the people I deal with and the kinds of things I think about, and just having that routine every day, that's why workplace turns up so often in my my stories. And I think that in a way law has crept in there. Like even the outsource, like I do like my job. And I'm not saying that because this is going to be on the radio. I do enjoy my job, but I have worked at law firms where, or I'm not at a law firm now, before when I worked at law firms, you build your time by the hour. And so that is kind of like my sort of default, you know, sort of sense of, that's like thinking about, when you have to bill your time by the hour, you do really think about your day differently. It's now been chopped up into economic units, right? And so that kind of transmutes into a story about a guy who literally is paid to feel other people's pain. Because it's like, you're sitting in the office and like, this is not my problem, but someone's going to pay me to, you know,
right,
to feel
you
his,
to make it your problem.
Yeah, to make,
which
to
makes
make
sense
it my problem.
Is what almost any economic exchange is, right? Is,
yeah.
Yeah. We have an audience question about female characters both in science fiction and in video games, and the somewhat complicated tradition of that, and do you see any progression in that, and how you see your place in that?
My place as a female video game character? Take a stab at guessing at maybe what the question is, that there aren't enough, and what ones there are often sort of visual stimulus for what is assumed to be the stereotypical player of a video game, which is a pre-adolescent or adolescent boy, or a grown man who still thinks like an adolescent boy. And I'm saying that as somebody who owns a video game console, so not judgmental at all. So it would be fabulous if video games were, you know, places where girls wanted to, you know, told the kinds of stories with the kinds of characters that young girls wanted to play just as much as young boys. Although I think there probably are games like that. I'm fairly sure there are some. Maybe it's not balanced, but it's probably catering to what the market is. In that sense, I'm not sure video games are a whole lot worse than just regular big old movies, probably. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe after I finish the Robot Lawyer movie, I will do...
Robot lawyers can be women, too. Can be sexist, robot sexist. moving on from the law perspective, you have two children now, right?
Yeah.
But for a long time, you've already been someone has a professional career and a family life, and also trying to integrate being a writer with that.
Yeah.
Has that been a productive process? Difficult one.
It has been. I think a couple years ago, I thought it was perfect. I was like, "Oh, it's great." Recently, it
what was your situation a couple years ago?
I think my kids were younger.
But you still had two even
the two,
then.
Two, yeah, uh-huh. They were 2 and 1. Now they're 4 and 3, and one's almost 5, and that is a lot harder. Mm-hmm. It's like it's just as much time, but now it's more mental energy. I don't have as much energy. Part of it is now I have to tell a lot of stories to my kids. And they are very, very brutal critics of my stories. This is my daughter. She's like the harshest editor in the world because she's not even an editor. She will tell me the entire story she wants me to tell her, verbatim. Then I have to remember it and tell it back. And wherever I deviate, she will slap me back into line. And then at the end, she'll go, I don't like that. And you made the story up. What are you talking about?
That sounds like a good editor, actually. That's my general approach. What is her stance on metafiction? Is she?
I think a kid is, in some ways, a natural metafictionalist. I think maybe that is, I'm going to make an excuse here for my metafictional indulgences, but I'm constantly telling them stories, and they're commenting on them, and they want to know how they work. You know, they want to know why a character does something. I mean, I guess that's specifically is not metafiction, but they don't necessarily know all of the tacit knowledge that a reader already sort of brings to
the
reading
questions story. You're not supposed to ask almost as a reader.
Exactly. Yeah. So everything is questionable. You know what I mean? And that is fun. It makes me think, and it also makes me realize sort of how bad I am at just painting a picture for them. It completely forces me out of my comfort zone. I don't get to go to the paper and just start musing on, you know, highfalutin stuff. I have to like tell them an entertaining story, and that's hard. That's hard for me, and it's really hard when you're also brushing their teeth at the same time.
Have they had any good ideas or?
Yeah, I steal all of their good ideas.
The level of the robot lawyers are not quite that good.
There yet.
Oh, there. Give them a couple years. It's important to not be too demanding as a father to ask for genius like the robot lawyer. Did you ever aspire, or do you still aspire to be a full-time writer, or does that feel like an unnatural existence to you?
I would, if it were possible, I would like it, but if it never happens, I would also be happy with that, I think, because it definitely brings a lot to my life to interact with people every day. I think if I had to sit with myself, you know, in a room 8 hours a day, I would get very good at video games, and I would I'll probably not produce as much as I'd like to think I would, so... I'm going to, you know, give you a non-answer and say either one.
Uh-huh. And as you were becoming a lawyer, I mean, did you ever consider going down that road and pursuing more of a direct literary career? Or what's the backstory, basically, of your evolution as a writer?
I actually started writing fiction right after I graduated from law school. So the two things coincided exactly. I've been a lawyer as long as I've been a fiction writer.
Was it a reaction to...
I think in some ways it was. Uh-huh. To an extremely different situation. I was, you know, 22, starting a brand new job, no idea what I was doing. I wasn't 22, I was 25. I was 25 and starting, you know, in a field that was terrifying and spending lots of time in a really sort of unnatural, to me, environment. And that did all sorts of interesting things to me. It hurt. It made me... I will say, though, it definitely is good for the work ethic. I think I can take a lot more physical and emotional punishment in terms of trying to get a product, a work product, good, you know, as good as I can possibly make it. And so I'm not sure I ever would have had the discipline to revise or to just deal with the really terrible first drafts and second drafts and third drafts. And eighth drafts, you know, and just work through it and go, I'm still working on this. I have to make it better.
If following up on that, so you've been moving back and forth between stories and novels. First was a story collection, then novel, then the story collection, now you're working on another novel. What is the experience of that different? I mean, is it particularly difficult to keep faith in the middle of a novel and that sort of long multi-year journey?
Yes, it was a little difficult, but I wrote, you know, my novel was 240 pages. and it was a single year journey, roughly. So, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but you edited a book that took 8 years to write. It was 1,000 pages long. And I was on a panel with the author of that book, and he talked a little bit about the process of writing and how much she changed as a writer from the beginning to the end, right? I mean, that must have taken feats of endurance and mm-hmm. patience that I can't even imagine. I don't know if you went through that with him or...
Well, the editing took over a year, so... Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I find with any project, there's always an interesting process of you're always going to think this is terrible at various points in the middle. You just have to learn to not think about that, just to say, sure, it's terrible, but I'm going to keep on going.
You hide it from your author?
I hide it from myself. I mean, you have to hide it from yourself just to keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And that just, you just get to know it's part of the process. You just want to quit and you don't.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, with some of these ideas, it seems like they have this really strong premise at their core. Is there ever a moment where you're deciding, is this a novel? Or is this a 3,000-word story?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and how do you make that decision?
Sometimes I try, and then thing curls onto itself, into itself,
mm-hmm.
or just kind of peters out. Sometimes I think something's going to be a lot bigger than it is, and it just was barely even a story.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Charles Yu, author of the acclaimed How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe. Here to discuss his newest book, Sorry, Please, Thank You. I'm Mila Horowitz, former managing editor and publisher at McSweeney's. And now just to make this extra, just take a turn for the boring, I'm curious personally to talk about the epigrams for this book. You have Sapir and Whorf are the two quotes at the beginning, sort of with quotes about language. And I was curious why. That seemed like a little bit of an incongruous choice as a science fiction author to whatever, not to mm-hmm. pigeonhole you and so forth. But I'm curious what led you, or should we read the quotes?
Yeah, sure.
Should you read the quotes?
I'd like you to read it. I think you...
Well, I'll read one of them.
Okay.
Benjamin Lee Whorf says, "We dissect nature along lines laid down by our native languages." And a portion of the Sapir one is, "Human beings do not live in the objective world alone, but are very much at the mercy of the particular language which has become the medium of expression for their society. The fact of the matter is that the real world is to a large extent unconsciously built upon the language habits of the group. No two languages are ever sufficiently similar to be considered as representing the same social reality." So why were those so meaningful to you?
I thought they sounded smart, and I wanted to put them at the front of the book and say, this is a book
clearly
by a
worked.
Smart person. I assume, Wikipedia is accurate in their quotes. It was helpful to me to think about in editing the stories, I needed to feel, since there's no sort of formal skin around the stories as a sort of device that ties, they're not linked stories. So unless you like linked stories, in which case they are linked stories. I needed some kind of like frame for myself to go, what was I doing here? Why are these? Because, I mean, I think there are similarities. I mean, I think there are definitely things that run through all of them that, or a lot of them. One of them would be, I guess the idea is you speak your native language, and that informs, not just informs, it dictates how you actually see the world. An extreme example would be, and I heard this on Radiolab, that if you, which I love, if they did some, they went to some tribe somewhere where there was no word for, I guess, the part of the electromagnetic spectrum that we would think of as blue, I think it was, right? I don't know if anyone's familiar with this episode of Radiolab, so tell me if I'm getting it wrong. just go like this if I'm getting it wrong. And I'm just going to paraphrase because then I'll be less likely to get it wrong. But basically, then they showed the people who spoke this language a bunch of squares, I think, or swatches of color, and they were blue or green. I'm probably flipping the colors, but... And basically, the people who spoke this language couldn't see that there was a difference in the color because they did not have a word for that color. That blew my mind. So, now how does that apply to a story collection where there's, you know, characters set in a video game world, or a different one where a guy thinks he's, you know, where a guy's, you know, he's on basically a sort of Star Trek-like ship, but it turns out he's on not just a, he's on kind of more like a TV show Star Trek, and, and he turns out to be the character who dies. I think that science fiction and these sort of artificial environments, video games, science fictional stories, just stories in general that in the way that we are used to them now, are a kind of like language, right? I mean, it goes back a little bit to the video game thing I was talking about. That's, or to use another example, like Facebook. I'm not a huge Facebook user, but, you know, on Facebook, you basically, there's a language to Facebook, right? It forces you to, the world of Facebook is very, very rigid. You can only do this on Facebook. You can't do this. You can't do that. You certainly can't do any of this, right?
For the radio audience, Mr. Yu is gesturing in different directions with his thumb.
Nice. Yes. So that's a word, and it's a lack of other words, right? A thumbs up is one word that you use on Facebook, and there's really not that many other words. You can comment. Of course, you can write comments. Yeah. But what are those, when we spend so much time in these artificial environments, they force us into different ways of navigating them. And after a while, that becomes a way we have relationships with people. Like, I gave my friend, you know, Eli, 8 thumbs up last week. I did. He had a picture. I thumbed it up. You know, I mean, I don't know. Does that do something to the way I relate to you? You know, I don't know. So that, I guess that's where, that's a very sort of roundabout way of trying to tie those, the Sapir and Worf, to these quirky science fiction stories.
It's interesting because then when you talk about, you know, you talk about your mother in relation to video games, I mean, how would she go about reading that sort of Star Trek-based story? It's almost like a language that she doesn't speak. How much do you think about other audiences or... You know, as a writer, in some sense, you're putting down words for all time.
Yeah.
Do you think about how that story will be read in 50 years, 100 years, even 10 years? Is that a concern of yours?
Now it is.
All right.
Jeez.
Shouldn't it be?
It's terrible now. Well,
Star Trek is, I mean, I'm sure in 10 years.
No, I mean, I think, okay, I do have an answer to that because, yes, it is something that I didn't think about enough probably when I was writing some of them, but if I had, I probably would have never written them. So in that sense, I don't feel sad about it.
Yeah.
But I do worry. There is definitely a worry, and it's something that, I think I worry about it in terms of I want people to read it and feel, you know, things, and I want to connect with people. And so if it's too private, or not even private, but it's too esoteric because it's you have to have played these video games to understand it, that worries.
I should say that I don't think that, I think timelessness is a particularly misguided goal almost for literature. I mean, everything is intentionally or accidentally embedded in its time, And in some sense, that's what literature can do best, is create a rich portrait of the time in which it was written. Mm-hmm. So don't worry about it.
You're just trying to...
No, man. It's
all right.
Timelessness. We're all going to die. The books... If the books... Even books still even exist, right, then you're lucky. There was a line I liked on page 42 that I threatened to ask you about earlier, and it was... I can read it. It's like all technology, either not powerful enough or too powerful. It will never do exactly what you want it to do. Mm. In some sense, that seemed like the kernel of a lot of your concerns, and maybe in some sense of all science fiction in general. Is that something you feel playing out throughout our modern world? Let the radio audience know I wiggled my fingers when I said our modern world. Continue.
Okay, duly noted. I don't know. I think this, that story in particular is called Troubleshooting, and it's about, it's not so clear at first, but it's not a long story, but within the course of the story, you come to understand that it's a kind of handheld wish fulfillment device. So you basically punch in some characters, and you basically put a wish in there, and the machine will make that, will transform your intention into results in the world. So I guess in the context of that story, that line was about how what we want is never exactly what we want. But you're right to hold it to the actual words. I mean, it was also about technology. So I don't know. I don't know if technology never matches up to what we want. I think some of it does.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you seem to use almost, not, you know, most obviously in that story, but throughout, technology as a means for wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
Which in some sense, I guess, is obvious, the purpose of anything. So if you're going to write a story about how what we want is often not really what we want,
yeah,
it makes sense that technology would often not really work quite how we intended it.
Yes. You put it better than I did.
Put it that way some more.
Yeah. Keep going.
Ah, you could. Yeah.
What else do I mean?
What about... Here's an audience question. Which writers do you read today? And particularly some lesser-known writers that maybe the audience isn't aware of.
Oh. That's sort of unfair, because I want to name a lot of people. But I will... I just finished... I read a story collection by a guy named Ben Lurie, which I really enjoyed. Stories for the Day and Some for Night. I think that's the title of the book. And it's sort of like a collection of fables. Thought that was fantastic. I really enjoyed Ben Lerner's book, I guess that's fairly well known, but maybe, Leaving the Atocha Station. Am I pronouncing that right?
I think that's right. That's how I was going to pronounce it. And that seems like an interesting... This is a book that's superficially entirely different than anything you'd write, I would say. I mean, it's about a graduate student in Spain, kind of writing poetry and kind of not.
Yeah.
Would that be a fair summary of the book? There's certainly nothing science fictional about it in any way. But it did seem to share certain concerns with your work. What is it about that work that grabbed you so much?
Well, first of all, I do note that both guys are named Ben. So I only read guys named Ben. The Lerner, his book was... he had such a careful and thoughtful and precise way of looking at his own thought processes. He's just incredibly good at articulating, not his, but I mean the narrator, the protagonist's thought process. And yet it wasn't, because even it was, I don't know, I mean, I'm left stumbling to describe it, but there was this kind of magical thing that happens similar to what I think Nicholson Baker can do, where it's like really rendering a consciousness and to actually believe that you are in someone's head and feel that, that would be, that's what I want to be able to do.
Well, something that that book does, and Nicholson Baker, and your own work, is there really are moments when you're thinking, like, wait, am I reading a novel? Am I reading a story? Or is this just this guy telling me things? Which, you know, you've actively blurred sometimes. You know, the protagonist of your novel was named Charles Yu.
Right.
What goes into that decision, and what are the pluses and minuses of making it?
The minuses are that people assume that you're talking
about them.
It's
crazy of them to think such a thing.
How
it's
dare
offensive.
You? The pluses are, in that book specifically, that it made the metafictional aspect sort of, it enhanced that, right? I mean, it could have just been a time travel story about a book which is being written as you read it. But then, on top of that, it's also a book, a time travel novel about a book that's being written as you read it by the guy who wrote it, about the guy who wrote it. So it was just like, how over the top can I go? You know, like ice cream plus sun, you know, chocolate plus cherry on top. Just make it, it might as well, right? I mean, because then it's going to be the, I want to just explode it into a metafictional mess. And so, and that was what it was, you know, for better or worse.
On a personal level, I mean, in this story collection, it seems there's nothing so overt as that, but in other ways, some of the stories felt even more nakedly personal. I mean, do you have to explain to your wife, like, this one's not me, don't worry, it's not me? You know, is that a concern when you're writing stories?
Not so much with my wife, I will say. Not just because her mom is in the audience, I think with her, it's actually so different from anything that we have, you know, that I would never worry about that. But with parent figures, I don't know why. There's always that danger. It's also that tradition of just like, oh, you know, I'm a novelist. I'm expected to just, you know, just like paint some portrait of my parents in my books, and then they'll know how I really felt all these years. I mean, I do worry about that, and sometimes I have preemptively try to warn them, like, no, like, uh-huh. It's not, this is not you.
Uh-huh. 'Cause, what if it is them? Do you still tell them it's not them?
Yes, I lie. Yes.
That's good.
Thank you for outing me.
No, and it's just public radio, I assume. How much do you think about science fiction as a genre? Is that something you concern yourself with, and the current state and the expectations and so forth?
Mm-hmm. I think about it a lot because it's so pervasive. I mean, I think about that, actually, the fact that it's so pervasive, which is really interesting to me. I mean, even basically all superhero movies, which in the summer is all movies, basically. That's science fiction, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's on my mind in the sense of, like, how much of pop culture it is. In terms of, like, the actual genre and people writing in science fiction, I mean, I read it. I do think of myself as, like, an outsider because I feel like one. But I hope a respectful outsider and someone who is interested in the genre and the conventions, not in a sort of judgmental or exploitative way, but in a way of like, some people work in this way in the genre, some people stand on the edge and kind of play around with the edge. And I, you know, that's what's interesting to me.
Are there other works, whether books or film or anything, that seem particularly interesting to you as kind of cross-genre work, like, say, like a movie like District 9 or mm-hmm. things like that? Do you feel like that's an area that's being plumbed in interesting ways?
Yeah, I mean, District 9 and another one that was sort of like that was Chronicle.
Uh-huh.
If you saw that.
Yeah,
I mean, if people have seen that. It's a superhero movie. It's kind of an origin story with three teenagers and three boys. And it's both of them, what they have in common is they don't have that kind of look and feel of a science fiction movie. They're kind of this. What's the term I'm looking for? It's kind of raw footage look, right?
They're right. Well, it's all like most of the camcorders.
Yeah,
is filming most of the movie. I guess officially all of the movie.
That's right.
Though they kind of. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're supposed to look kind of grainy and raw and, but even in the way they tell the story, it's not so much about effects or costumes or mythologies or world shaking, you know, sort of disasters. It's about the human parts of what happens, you know, to these people that, you know, happen to be in a story that has fantastic elements. But mm-hmm. I think those are definitely things that are that I get that I draw some inspiration from.
It's interesting the way it seems that modern science fiction is operating on these two parallel paths of, you have this kind of cliche of people being, you know, almost ashamed or something, you have to be under your covers and it's ghettoized in the section of the bookstore and so forth. On the other hand, it really is almost the dominant mode of our pop culture,
right.
It is our science fictional universe. Do you think those worlds are converging, or is it actually almost two separate paths of what
I like the way you put it.
Means?
It is weird, right? It's like people will line up for the next Batman or Avengers or whatever. I mean, those are sort of like, and then at the same time, if you like put a science fiction book in front of them, you might as well be putting like pornography in front of them.
Right.
Like, oh my God! Like,
right.
No, that's not no.
Right.
I think there is that kind of. What do you think? I mean,
well, I guess it seems
why?
Like literature maybe is diverging because literature has to be literary, and there are certain realms that are accepted as literature.
Yeah.
Whereas somehow movies is a more blurry realm. Are there other writers who you think are doing an interesting job of blurring these categories?
I think there are a lot. But wait, if I can go back.
Yeah,
please. Why do you think there has to be that?
Well, certainly it doesn't have to be. I guess it's because literature is, for the most part, still like, if you read a book, it's kind of a weird thing to do in our world. And
shameful.
So
yes. Yeah.
You're sort of identifying yourself as high culture in some way, whatever that means, highbrow. And so it doesn't have that sort of same kind of blurriness. There's no book really anymore that, it's rare for everyone to want to read a book the way there'll be a movie that just everyone will see.
Yeah.
So this is not really an answer, but it seems that movies can kind of steamroll the culture in a way, in a kind of positive sense almost, that kind of renders those divisions irrelevant. But if you're a reader, that carries with it other associations.
Yeah.
Because it's already kind of like an isolated medium to some extent.
That's really interesting. I think the Robot Lawyer book, though.
Well, sure, that's going to bridge all the gaps.
That will steamroll the culture.
I mean, you said you take a year to write a book? It's no problem at all. Make this a novella. Just give me 20%. I mean, it's a good book.
Now I'm flipping it again. So your next project is coming out on iPad and iPhone.
I should talk about that.
Yeah,
I'm allowed to, but we're talking about
technology.
Well, I mean, I think it is, you know, as an editor and publisher and sometimes writer, it's an interesting thing where at McSweeney's we always took a lot of care in the physical objects of the book and how to design them and how to really earn the paper. Mm-hmm. In some sense that this is going to be a print object. How can it be necessarily a print object?
Mm-hmm.
And then meanwhile, we were sort of having to put things on the Kindle, and it was sort of a depressing process. Not that I really care that much about like the smell of the paper and so forth, but we spent time making this thing nice and look the way we want and be structured the way we want and what's a chapter look like and what's an image look like and what's the cover. And then you put it on the Kindle and it just like, you know, squishing some gray slurry into the thing.
Right.
It just becomes like a vessel for text. So I got to thinking, these devices should open up new possibilities in storytelling instead of just being lesser forms of what we already have. There's things that a book is the best thing at doing, better than a Kindle. what can an iPad do that a book can't do? And so this is a project we've been working on that's sort of a combination of serialization and site-specific storytelling, where partly it comes to you in pieces every day, partly you have to explore the physical world to get new pieces of the story, partly it's collaborative. So it's an attempt to take
like a new kind of storytelling.
That would be the goal. We'll see. Wow. I mean, I don't know whether this will be that, but I do know that's what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. I do believe writers should be the leaders in those new things, because right now it's being kind of deferred to the people who are making platforms, people who want to sell you things, people mm-hmm. who have the money to program the things. It's not a place where new things are being created, where that's leading the forums. So
it's fascinating. Wow. Yeah.
We just have a few more minutes, but maybe a good closing question will be, this is from the audience, that Chris Abani once said that every writer has his or her own particular unanswerable question about what disturbs them or fascinates them or whatever. What is your question? Is there something that's sort of driving you that you're continually trying to get to the bottom of?
No, I pretty much...
They're all answered.
Not that curious, yeah. No, I don't. I don't think there's any particular thing. I mean, I think... Is there a question? Not really. I mean, I think it's a lot of questions for me.
I mean, there's a sense of identity.
Yeah.
Of figuring out oneself and one's place within one's world seems to drive you, and the rules of that world, a tension between what you want and what you get, mm-hmm. and whether you want to get what you want. Do you want to talk at all about your next work, about the kind of the tension at the core of it, even if some of the story is still unclear?
Well, yeah, I mean, the next one is, in the vaguest possible terms, it will be a book.
Seems a little specific.
And it's going to have, at its core, a relationship of a father with his children, told from the perspective of the father. And it will be about storytelling and metaphor, and how metaphor sort of is the way, you know, how we learn metaphor and how pervasive it is in sort of seeing the world. I just made that up.
No, that's good. It writes itself. Well, maybe that can be it for tonight. I'd like to thank Charles Yu, author of How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe.
Thank you.
And his new book is a story collection, Sorry, Please, Thank You. Tonight's event is part of Club's Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I'm Miller Hartz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Nice.